Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
The Market Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Welcome back to the Market Musings Podcast here, where today our guest from Atome Energy PLC, the CEO Olivier Mussat, is joining us. So hello, Olivier. Thank you very much for your time today. How are you doing?
Very well. Thank you very much, Mark, for having us.
Now, I'm looking forward to doing this podcast. I know you did an introduction, sort of overview interview with us not so long ago to get a bit of an idea of what the company's all about. But this longer format podcast, we'll be talking a bit more about you and where you've come from and what's taken you on your journey to where you are now with Atome Energy, and hopefully learning a little bit more perhaps about Atome Energy and what's to come. So looking forward to it. And of course, Kenny as well is here joining us from, is it hot Scotland? I know in Rotterdam today it's very hot.
Yeah, there's a funny blue sky in Scotland, which we don't see very often. I think it was about 24, 25 yesterday, and I think it's to be the same for us again today, which is tropical for Scotland. So it is, but
indeed,
I'm sure it's a lot warmer where you guys are, and especially you, Olivier. Where are you calling from today?
Well, today I'm calling from London, and yeah, London is it's hot and dry. But you know, after living 9 years in Washington D.C., where it was hot and very humid, I'm not complaining.
You're not complaining. Okay, good, good. Yeah, London can be unbearably warm there, particularly if you're travelling on the underground, as I was just at the weekend, actually. It's not the best way to travel around London in the hot weather, but we can't complain. The Brits Indeed. Have a bad habit of complaining about the weather all the time, so let's move on from that. So, listen, thank you very much for joining us today. I'm looking forward to learning a bit more about you. So, I mean, the general format of the podcast is really to go back, deep dive where you've come from. And you know, you can go back as far as you like, Olivier, if you want to go back to school time or university, but certainly early careers and what you've been doing. And just talk to us a little bit about you, really, and your past. So happy to sort of let you take it away to begin with, and we'll sort of come in with questions as and when.
It sounds good. Well, hopefully it doesn't turn into a psychologist couch, but I'm happy to, absolutely. So, well, as you may hear from my accent, I was born and raised in France, between Paris and Normandy, and actually, so French father, and actually a mother, an English mother, born in Southsea, you know. Actually, not allowed to say Portsmouth, you had to say South Sea. Mm-hmm. So a little bit of, you know, both cultures in the blood. And actually, between living in the UK and the US, I've lived most of my life in English-speaking countries, but I haven't been able to get rid of the French accent. I've tried. Mm-hmm. So so between Paris and Normandy, went to school in France. Spend a bit of time in university in the US, and as well as did my master's degrees in France in a French engineering school called Centrale in Paris. And I think career-wise, you know, the energy sector was always fascinating to me because it was really the intersect of you know, politics, macroeconomics. And actually, if you were in the, you know, pure oil and gas exploration side, there was a little bit of, you know, let's be honest, I want to say, you know, technical gambling, where you're really hoping, you know, for the best, and but also with a very high degree of improbability into what you were doing. Mm-hmm. So from an attraction, you know, really the energy sector was really where I had a few things I liked, right? I always liked what was going on in the world, you know, from a politics point of view, from a global economy point of view. And I really thought that we, you know, if you see some of the largest issues we've had, and I think Ukraine is a very good reminder of that. It's is that, well, essentially energy drives policy and drives politics. And sometimes it's a weapon, and sometimes it's a tool for good. So with that in mind, in my studies, I really was going for on the energy side. And my first job was actually a commissioning engineer in the power sector. And it was with a company called then Ecolochem, which was then bought by GE. And what we were doing was, you know, if you guys remember, late 90s, I think oil was around, you know, $9 a barrel. And peaking gas was all the rage in the UK and Europe. So I was out there commissioning power plants. And in 2004, 2005, I moved to Schlumberger on the oil and gas side. And there I was really working a lot on the, a little bit of engineering side, but then moved very quickly to a department called MERAC, which was the economics and portfolio management team. So I was there dispatched to a number of our client companies, helping them on evaluating the assets, looking at strategic divestments, also, you know, what was going to be the next development program. And it was really a great experience because I ended up going into places like, you know, Angola, Congo, Iran, Algeria, even in the US, even on the North Sea. So really, you know, quite a fantastic time to exactly when emerging markets were growing at lightning speed. 2008, just before the credit crunch hit, a number of banks were developing very fast their oil and gas practices. So after quite a number of conversations with a number of banks, because, you know, I thought that, you know, from my point of view, I thought, well, I understand the engineering side. I understand how to run the numbers. I'm really curious about how do you finance these massive multi-billion dollar projects? And I talked to a number of banks, and I found a really good fit with Standard Chartered Bank, which is based in the UK, but actually has its roots in Africa and Asia.
Yep.
And I had a wonderful 4 years over there. I had great, great colleagues, you know, a couple of incredible mentors. One, you know, Ade Adeola, who was the head for Africa and energy at the time. Another one called Andrew Bartlett, who is pretty well known in the oil and gas side. And I was able to look at very large project finance, large acquisition, M&A, you name it. And also we were there at the early stage of the of financing LNG projects. So, for example, I was involved into the financing of Sakhalin with Shell, which was, you know, really interesting at the time, because a lot of people say, oh, you know, gas is very hard to transport abroad. Is it really going to work? And we saw that very early on that, you know, it grew. LNG market grew a lot faster than what anybody expected. So during that time at Standard Chartered, I ended up, I think my last post there was co-head of the oil and gas project finance department. And I had worked a couple of times on a couple of projects with the IFC. IFC is the International Finance Corporation. It's the investment arm of the World Bank. Mm-hmm. And where we had a really good fit again, you know, investing in emerging markets across sectors. Obviously, with a, you know, force for good use of capital, right, view. And I thought we had a really good fit, again, Marty, just from an interesting point of view, where the IFC was doing a lot on the equity side, so really principal investments in projects, in companies. And from my point of view, I thought that I was at a point where I really understood well the financing, the debt financing side, the M&A side. But I was really curious about the equity side. And so we found this really good fit. Also had a great boss then, a guy called Lance Christ, who is obviously also quite well known. He's a career guy at the IFC. He's done incredible deals all across. And again, very fortunate. We keep talking about people, right? You can have, you know, great institutions, but you really stick with people. And so I joined the team. We grew the portfolio in oil and gas for about $2.2 billion of assets, I think, by 2015. And in 2015 at the World Bank, you know, we announced that actually, you know, the climate issues, emergency, you name it, was becoming front and center. That honestly, finding financing for oil wasn't that difficult anymore, even in the, you know, in the deepest parts of emerging markets. So the role for the World Bank should shift from the oil and gas side and really much more towards the renewable side. And honestly, there was a little bit of soul searching. You know, we had to remotivate the team. And what we ended up doing was merging the oil and gas team and the power team, which at the time had mostly invested in a lot of, let's say, gas-fired power plants, you know, diesel, transmission lines, but had also really started to take big leadership in wind power and solar power. But, you know, hydrocarbons were still the bigger piece. And so in 2015, so it took us about 2 years to really get comfortable, to merge the two teams, to get used to the skills that all we all had. And by 2019, so we had these two portfolios together represented about $11 billion of infrastructure energy assets. And we had shifted from being 60-70% hydrocarbon based or linked to 60% renewable linked. And so quite, you know, quite an achievement again. You know, just because the people really gelled together and really went forward with a mission, as I said, it wasn't easy, right? But we made it happen, and so I ended up being chief investment officer for the global energy side, and also took quite a keen interest on the new tech side of things, which was battery storage and hydrogen, and so I ended up speaking to a lot of our former clients and say, well, listen, you know, if we can do it at the World Bank, you know, which is an incredible organization on many points of view, you have the smartest people you will ever meet in your entire life, but they are not, you know, it's not the same drive as the private sector, so it takes a bit longer, and also there's a lot of inertia. But if we can make it work in a place with a lot of inertia, imagine what we could do in the private sector. And trying to explain to our clients, listen, there's a lot of transferable skill set. There's a lot of things you are doing as developers of oil and gas or power assets to look at these newer technologies, even in the emerging market context. So I stayed, I thought, honestly, thought I was going to stay about 4 to 5 years at the IFC, and then I ended up staying 9 years. And that's all because I was having a lot of fun in the most a true sense of a word, which I never went to work thinking it was work. And I really was so happy to do things which you believe in, and you have a large organization behind you, which is far from being perfect. It's far from being isolated from global politics. You have to remember that at the World Bank, you know, we essentially have more than 180 shareholders, and that we have more than 20 board members from which are all seconded from their own finance ministries or foreign ministries. So you end up in presenting projects. You know, these people are generalists and come from a economist background. So they are not specialists whatsoever, but they really understand the picture. And it was, you know, Dragon's Den every single time. And also with, you know, some interesting characters and interesting egos, right? So, and sometimes you get stuck in, you know, in the crossfire of global politics, where you see projects not being approved because there are some problem in one country and another country is very concerned about it, and sometimes you see projects which honestly, you know, don't look good on paper, but have so much of a potential impact on the ground in the country for the people you give access to water, or power, or food. That you just say, yes, it's very likely we will lose money, but the people will benefit much, you know, will benefit from this greatly. So it is absolutely worth the risk. And it's not something you can do in a regular private equity world. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So I've, you know, before I get into Atome, I think it's, you know, that's really what I want to leave with, which is, I know there's a lot of people who have certain opinion of global institutions, but in the end, it's, you know, it's all about people, right? It's and if you have the right people at the helm, the right CEOs, the right VPs, with the right motivation, incredible things can happen.
Yeah, I think investors are a lot more savvy nowadays, Olivia, and what they do is, the olden days, you didn't really do much research, but now there's so much information available on the web about the people behind the company, the projects and your background and your career, that people want that almost like that comfort blanket of a successful career before they part with their money. So people make companies, so they do. I'm with you. I don't care what, if you've got a 1 or 10 million ounce gold deposit, if you've not got the right people in that company to drive that forward, then it's worthless. So it is. But I just want to jump back, because obviously it's quite an interesting journey, Olivia, because obviously you were at the coalface to begin with as a field engineer. Can you just expand on what you actually done at GE for the 4 years? Because obviously you meet a lot of different people at the coalface, and most of them are characters, because that's my kind of background. I've been an engineer most of my life, and you meet all people from all walks of life, so you do.
You do, right? And I think also it's an incredible experience, because you have all backgrounds, all working towards the same goal. And also it's when you're turning spanners, it's a great equalizer, right? Because you'll be sitting next to a guy who's got multiple PhDs, and somebody who, to your left is a regular Sparky who's been there for 30 years and who's done it all, right? So to an extent, it's almost like going to the army, frankly. I was actually all across, on the energy side, where most of our work was on the commissioning of peaking gas, but actually in what I was doing more specifically was on the water treatment side. So as you guys know, when you commission any type of industrial facility, you need a lot of deionized ultra pure water to go and to use steam to clean things when you run turbines. Especially in the fine heat, you put also deionized water into your system to increase efficiency of the turbines, and also if you work on the refinery side, you also need to make sure you have the right water, the right amount of quality of water, and what I learned there very quickly is that, unfortunately, water is, less than 2% of the cost, but it's nearly 50% of the reason that you have to shut down facilities. And you realize, you are part of this ecosystem, and you are working, on a sometimes 24/7 rhythm, that everybody has to play its part, no matter how small. And if you want to get problems done or resolved, you have to be incredibly honest and incredibly transparent, because sometimes the smallest mistakes can lead to a loss of life, right? If I'm in banking, honestly, my biggest mistake would maybe slip onto my Excel spreadsheet, and then there's an extra zero or a zero missing, right? Okay, well, it's, I'm not a trader, so nobody would directly lose money, but okay, worst case scenario, you lose a few hours. If suddenly I close the wrong valve, well, somebody can be on the other side of that pressure point, and the whole thing can explode in his face. So I think I learned responsibilities like that at a very young age. Also, I was ingrained, and I give credit to Schlumberger on this one, on the health and safety side. That how important it is, and also again, you touched on the people side, Kenny, but that in the end, people are your biggest assets, So it's, yes, you have this great power plant, and which may be worth, 200 million, 2 billion, 10 billion if it's a nuclear power plant. But without the people, it doesn't run, right? So treating the people right and making sure they are part of a team is certainly quite important. Certainly don't want to have people to think I loved it. I mean, I can remember being at one point I was on the Backton terminal. I was managing the replacement of a MEG unit. So you put MEG into the gas pipeline so that you don't have water freezing into the pipelines. So it's pretty nasty stuff, right? So it's not exactly the job you want to do, but somebody has to do it. And I remember having to park my car 500 meters away from the gate because it's a big, big facility. You don't want anything running in there that is uncontrolled. And having, where was it? I think 6 a.m. in December with the rain coming horizontally in my face, right? So not the best thing in the world. But again, it builds character, right?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, I'll let you in the mark a minute, Mark. Sorry, I know you're wanting to come in. I mean, it's quite interesting because it's almost as like you started off with an overall, and now you've moved up to, I'm going to say, a suit for want of a better term. What did you pick that career path, or did it just happen? Like most careers, you know, so you can never plan a career. Sometimes it just happens.
So yeah, sure. Itself. So I still have my overall and I still have my toolbox. Right? And use my toolbox, right? So I don't use it. I use it to repair motorcycles now. I don't use it to do anything, you know, remotely similar to what I used to do, right? I think I picked it from an interest point of view, right? I've been the type of person who learns much more by doing than in books, right? I love reading, don't get me wrong, but I think the curiosity comes in that I just, you know, I need to understand how it's done and I need to see, you know, how people do it. So that's why, you know, I mean, I went from a career at Standard Chartered where I was making, you know, a very, very good living to one where I took, honestly, a salary cut to join IFC. Well, number one, because it's a global institution, part of the World Bank. So clearly you don't expect to work for these places and make the same money as investment bankers. But I was fine with that because I wanted to learn something new. Right? So it's the way I've functioned, right? It's curiosity. I always wanted to know and be able to work in the energy side, but I really wanted to be able to say and to understand how it works. And it's also one of the reasons I went into banking. Like, why is it that, you know, chose me versus another graduate from Harvard? It's just like, well, actually, because I could, you know, relatively call bullshit because I knew some of these things that didn't make sense, that make sense on paper. But then you can ask a question. It doesn't mean I know how to do it better than a 40-year-old engineer. Absolutely not. But I know to ask a question that is missing.
Yep, makes sense. Mm. No, it's interesting. You know, your career's kind of been guided by curiosity. I think mine's more, you know, of opportunity that's just presented itself. What about you? You're maybe a bit different, Mark, because obviously you worked for your dad for most of your life. I'll let you in, Mark. Sorry.
Yeah, I suppose that mine was more opportunity. This opportunity to do what we're doing now was a new one, and of course the opportunity my dad gave me. So it probably was more of a what was happening at the time sort of thing. I did like what you said, Olivier, about that kind of team ethic. And I know my father was big on that in his company, and he always referred to the team as a rugby team, and you know how important that team. In fact, we had rugby shirts printed with the logo on and like a bit of a mission statement for the company. But I think it's very important for people to feel valued in a team, to feel they are part of achieving something bigger together, let's say. And the power of a team is much more than the individual. So, I mean, presumably, before we get into Atome, that I guess is a big part of your management strategy, your CEO role at Atome. Would you say?
It even was at the conception, right? So, you know, why did I move from a job which was guaranteed for life with a pension guaranteed for life? Into some place where I ended up putting my own money and not an insignificant amount of money. And again, took a salary cut, but also I think it's a great way to see if people are motivated, is, you know, everybody took a cut to join a young company. And it's all a people's thing because we were incubated within a company which was an IFC investment and called President Energy. And it's because it's somebody with Peter Levine, our chairman, who I really learned to appreciate and trust. And when, you know, I was actually pitching to him, say, hey, you know, in President Energy, you guys have presence in Paraguay. I know the, you know, the oil and gas side didn't work out, but the potential of Paraguay and the electricity side, therefore the hydrogen side, is absolutely there. What do you think about this? And so we had a lot of back and forth, thinking I was creating more, you know, possibly new business for IFC. And to the point that he said, listen, I think I absolutely get the idea. I get what you want to do. And actually, we've been looking at solar things in Argentina, for example, to improve our operations. But I don't have the capacity to do it internally. So we needed to do it outside. And, you know, would you take the helm? And so it's, which I did, but after I spent a fair amount of time, number one, putting, you know, in making the business plan into a format that I, as an investor, would have invested in, and also putting a team which was a complementary team together. So if you go to Atome's website, you will see that we have people on the ground. So our two assets are Paraguay and Iceland to start with, but we never wanted to be seen to be a company run from the UK, and then we would fly in once in a while into the country that we operate in, and in banking, we used to call, you know, when we would see American investment bankers come into Nigeria, for example, we used to call them seagull banker, you know, which is you fly in, you shit all over the place, and then you fly out. and somebody has to clean it, right? And then us, who were in the coal mine on this stuff and who knew exactly what happened, we would have to clean the mess, and it would take us a lot of time. So so similarly for me, it was about finding the right people on the ground who could deliver these projects, which, you know, they're not small projects, but they're not big either, but they have huge impact on the ground. And you have, and sustainability comes from being able to work with the local communities, with the local political environment, with the local economic environment. And so, you know, it took us quite a few months to find James Spalding, who is the Atome president for Paraguay. And Jim, when we were looking, we had three names that we were evaluating, and Jim was, you know, above anybody else. Obviously, from his background, he used to run the Itaipu Dam, which is our source of power, for 5 years. He was Minister of Finance. He was a representative for Paraguay at the World Bank, at the IADB. So he was somebody who is not a politician, like really a technocrat, but somebody who also understood the energy sector, who also understood and who had, let's say, a third-party review of who he is, because you don't become administrator at the World Bank if you are not whiter than white on the ethics sense, right? But more importantly, we saw that somebody who was incredibly smart, but also incredibly humble, and completely level-headed. And again, that's quite refreshing, because we want people to be to have that character, because it's otherwise, if ego comes in too much, you need a little bit of ego to get your message across sometimes, mm-hmm. and to negotiate. But at the same time, if you have too much ego, then you take things personally, and then the ego comes into the decision making, and that becomes wrong very, very quickly. So again, I think that was one part. The other part was at the board, we have Mayrose de Valadares, who I met when I was in Washington, D.C. And for 15 years, she was the general manager of the Hydrogen Partnership Unit. And she used to work at the U.S. government National Renewables Lab. So she had seen the promises, the disappointments of hydrogen, and she had contacts all across. So, as you said, you know, in the end, the smart investors invest in people, and the projects that work well work well because of the people and because of the team. So, and for some who have worked in oil and gas, you know, you always saw the difference when an asset had the A team and the asset had the C team, and a company like Perenco, for example, who isn't very well known, but the old business bundle that they had was identify assets where Exxon or Chevron would put the C or the D team, and they would buy it on the cheap, and they would put their own A team, and lo and behold, you know, production would go up two or three times, right?
Yeah, it's amazing what a difference a team can make. There's a stock that I know very well. It's a big success story on the London market. So it's Greatland Gold, and that was just hovering around, not doing much with a team that was you know, sort of a bit demotivated, sort of stuck in the ways, and just a change of management there, you know, invigoration, let's say, completely transformed that company. Obviously, a discovery of significant gold resource helped as well. But, you know, would that have happened if the management team hadn't changed around a bit? Probably not, I would say. So you're totally right there. So was Atome Energy, was it your idea then that you've sort of founded and put together, built the team? I mean, how old is the company?
Oh, well, it's, you know, I'm certainly not taking any credit whatsoever for the idea, right? Mm-hmm. It all comes from a lot of the work that Peter with President has put in. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I'm part of the execution side and enabling side. So I think our first discussions, Peter and I, and again, it was on the side of me, you know, really trying to, you know, identifying where would be the next hydrogen hotspots. Okay, so let's start with that. You know, obviously, the hydrogen economy itself, it's, as I said, you know, we've been producing hydrogens for nearly 100 years. Right? There's nothing new in it. You know, electrolyzers are more than 80 years old now. So it's, but with the scale we are looking at and what needs to happen for the green hydrogen side, it's the reality is you need a lot of electricity and you need it at a very cheap price. And you need to be able to sell your product into a place where the other products are more expensive, you know, i.e. diesel or fertilizers. So otherwise, you need a very large amount of subsidies, which is what's happening now in Europe, happened a little bit in the UK, and will be happening in a big scale in the US. Because 70% of the cost of producing hydrogen is directly related to the cost of electricity. The same way that producing gray hydrogen, so from natural gas and coal seam, it's between 70% of 90% of the cost of that gray hydrogen is related to the hydrocarbon molecule. But it's as simple as that. There is no magic behind it. So we saw that there were a couple of specific places where you could do it and do it quickly. And Paraguay is one of them, and actually is the best one globally, because Paraguay, and people don't really know Paraguay, it's a landlocked country in the middle of Latin America, in between Brazil, Chile, Bolivia, Argentina, and yet it's the most democratic country, stable democratic country. It's a center-right country. It's double B plus rated by S&P and Moody's. It's an export-based economy, so dollarized economy. It's the world's fourth largest exporter of soybean, for example. And it's also the world's largest exporter of renewable energy, because 40 years ago, the country and Brazil decided to invest into the Itaipu Dam, which is 14 gigawatts. It's the second largest hydroelectric dam in the world after the Gorges Dam in China. But out of this 14 gigawatt, it's 7 gigawatt for Paraguay, 7 gigawatt for Brazil. But Paraguay historically has only used between 2 to 4 gigawatt of power every single day, because it's not a very deep industrial country at all. Mm-hmm. So it's been selling the excess to Brazil. Mm-hmm. And so what they realize is that how can they become more economically competitive when they have to import more than $1 billion of fertilizer a year and more than $1 billion of diesel a year, because it's also a country you've got more than I forgot the exact number of barges, but nearly 3,000 barges on the water every single day to import and export goods across the Paraná to Paraguay River via Argentina, Uruguay. So, well, the way to do it, especially as, you know, as electrolyzers were getting cheaper and efficiency happened, was actually let's use domestic electrons to create domestic molecules. And then you will not need the $100 million diesel subsidy that you have to pay every single quarter. Your production of agriculture will be able to grow, because you will be, you know, with hydrogen, you make ammonia. So if I am able to produce fertilizer domestically, I can reduce the cost of fertilizer, which means I can reduce the cost of producing soybean, which means it will be easier for me to sell it globally, so I can increase production and increase wealth for my country. So macroeconomics, right? This is kind of where you start with. And then you find the opportunity from the macroeconomic point of view. Where do you find your differentiator? And then after that, you know, you go and you put the people, because otherwise, if, you know, I can have the best team in the world, if his work, if that team is working in Russia today, nothing will happen, right? So or things will happen, but you know, downstream of that thing is not going to be very useful. So so it's, that's kind of how the thesis started, and also what I saw was that, you know, as an investor in of very large numbers, we saw that you have a huge growth into the green infrastructure funds, all chasing the same thing, which is, well, what can we do to help decarbonize and working into the climate change strategy and investment strategy. Because, you know, let's be honest, it's, you know, climate investment is kind of a new tech, right? It's and so you have billions and billions and billions of dollars available, but not that many projects to allocate to. So I was exactly, as an investor in that case, where I was outcompeted on really interesting projects because there was so much money flowing. And I would see investors, and including very large smart ones, beggars can be choosers, and they would negotiate themselves because they have to spend that money as a private equity fund or as an infrastructure fund. Also because of the promises they made to the investors, which is, no, I will invest into green, you know, climate urgency is real, all of these things. And if you're a project developer and a smart one, you realize that you have all of these pressure points, so you can get them to compete. And today you have wind farms in the US, in Europe, where infrastructure investors are coming in, and you look at the real numbers and they're looking at 2% returns before inflation, right? So it's pretty insane in a way, right? So I decided that for me, two things, right? Number one, from a commercial point of view, and where I wanted to be in my career, was to be on the project side, because it was the idea was, if I can have more impact, it's going to be on creating a project which is good enough for investors to come into. And then there's the climate side, which is we are seeing a huge shift in our energy mix. It's going as fast as it can go with what we have, right? There's a number of, you know, it's very hard to change the energy systems, and we can talk about that for a long time. But everybody has to do their little, you know, 0.5% plus 0.5% plus 0.5%. And over time, you know, we will get there. It's going to, that transition is going to take a very long time. But if everybody is waiting for everything to be here, we're not going to move very fast. And the reason I say that, it's, I can remember in 2018, 2019, we were having discussion with one of the largest utility, at the World Banker, with one of the largest utility player in the world, on hydrogen project in Chile. And you say, well, why Chile? Well, Chile is one of the places in the world where you have the highest concentration of solar. So you would think that on a 5 to 10 year basis, with the cost of solar decreasing, you install solar panels there, so you can produce hydrogen for cheap. And you start with a domestic market for hydrogen, which actually is the mining operations. So they would displace diesel in the large mining trucks and diggers by hydrogen, because in large scale unit it works. You also can transform that hydrogen into ammonia, but ammonia for explosives. Again, that's a great market. And then after that, you grow into hydrogen for exports. And all looks great on paper. Macroeconomic is fantastic. And I think we really get along well with the business development team of that utility. And their plan is, well, if we do all of these steps, it's a $1 billion investment over the next 5 to 10 years. Say, okay, well, if you guys are ready to go, we will follow as investor. And they went back to their board and they say, well, we need, you know, this is the plan, it's going to take up to $1 billion. This is the opportunity. The World Bank is ready to follow us, all of these things. And response of the board, which is a board which would say very publicly, we need to go green, we need to go faster. Company X is committed to do this. That same board says, that's great, guys. We think it's too early. You will get $10 million. And by the way, most of that $10 million will have to come from public funding, not from our own balance sheet, which is a multi-billion dollar balance sheet. So you realize the disconnect between, you know, the wants, the opportunities, and to an extent, you know, also some shareholder pressure. But you realize that these next moves that we want to do, that we can do, they will, you know, it won't come from the large utilities of this world. It will come from the smaller developers who would then bring things to a scale that that becomes mature enough for the big money mm-hmm. and the big utilities to come in.
Mm-hmm. It's always the case, though, isn't it? When there's a shift going on, it's always, yeah, you lack the interest, you lack the kind of appetite for it. But you seem to be here right at the very start of it. I noticed that you've got the London Stock Exchange Green Economy. I don't know if that's it must be an official kind of badge or emblem there of the green economy. And we do hear about this quite a lot. There's not that many opportunities out there, but like you say, it's the new tech. I think it will be the new tech. I think things like tech and the crypto will go out of favor. And, you know, the next thing that the youth are going to pick up on, who are crypto investors of today, will be the green economy, the green tech investors of tomorrow. As well as of course the metals as well, the metals market. We need metals to go green as well. But I wonder if then if you can maybe I understand the business model here to mm-hmm. create hydrogen requires energy, use an electrolyzer to split the molecule. And you're in Paraguay, you're using the energy from the hydro dam, presumably to mm-hmm. generate energy to do that. And the same in Iceland, but mm-hmm. instead it's using the geothermal to mm-hmm. so sourcing economically, you know, cheaper electricity in order to actually produce the hydrogen. But there's a couple of things I want to talk about. The first one is generally you mentioned this hydrogen economy, so I want to understand a little bit more about the opportunity for hydrogen going forward. But also, I think you mentioned ammonia, and you have this sort of, I don't know if it's unique, but it's a very interesting way of actually transporting the hydrogen rather than as a gas, but as ammonia. Is that right?
That's correct, and I think the way we say things now, or we try to explain, is, you know, hydrogen is the hook. I think it's what it's ingrained in the mind of the people now that it's like, okay, this is the next natural gas, it's the next LNG, it's hydrogen, right? It's a molecule you can use into the natural gas systems. I think it's, on one hand, it's easier to understand, but the hydrogen market itself is completely nascent. Mm-hmm. Now, the advantage of hydrogen, it's a base chemical. Right? It's a molecule. That's what it is. And with hydrogen, once you have produced your hydrogen, you can actually use it as the base chemical to create ammonia. And so, what you would do is, you know, as you say, you start with water, pure water, put it through an electrolyzer, which separates the H and the O's. That H is the hydrogen. Then you have a Haber-Bosch process, which strips nitrogen from the air. Again, like, it's just electricity. It's, you know, Haber-Bosch is a 100-year-old process, nothing new. And you combine the nitrogen and the hydrogen to create NH3, which is ammonia. And ammonia itself today, 70% of all ammonia is used to create fertilizers. I mean, the rest, it's a mix of things along the industrial chain. And what we are seeing is that it's an existing globally traded commodity. So the worst thing you can do is you produce a product, hydrogen, that nobody is going to use. Right? There is no market. But I am producing ammonia in my first phases, and in the, you know, in the medium term, I will continue to produce ammonia from day one, because there is a global market for ammonia. Right, because it's a chemical compound which is used, as I say, mostly on fertilizer. And as you mentioned earlier, also hydrogen is great, but it's very difficult to transport on long distances. Exactly like natural gas. You know, why do we have LNG, liquefied natural gas? It's because you couldn't transport natural gas if you didn't have a pipeline system. So you would liquefy it, and you can produce natural gas in the US for cheap. Liquefy it, sell it, send it into Europe, and then you transform it back from a liquid to a gas. And if you wanted to do that with hydrogen right away, well, the hydrogen molecule itself, it only becomes liquid at minus 260 degrees Celsius, which is, you know, 100 degrees Celsius colder than LNG. So you can imagine the amount of power you need to that. Mm. And on top of that, it's a molecule which takes quite a bit of space. So what you can, and so the energy content of hydrogen isn't that big. However, if you transform hydrogen into ammonia, ammonia liquefies itself at minus 33 degrees Celsius, and you only use very bog standard ships, which have, again, which is, you know, there's a global market of ammonia LPG ships out there. And it's three times denser in energy content than hydrogen. So what you do is you transform that hydrogen into liquid ammonia and you transport it. And at destination, as you ship it, let's say to Japan, you transform the ammonia back into hydrogen and you use it as hydrogen into the system. So that's the interesting bit about ammonia too. So what we are seeing is ammonia as a molecule where suddenly, instead of using just fertilizer, it will start to be used to transport hydrogen. Mm-hmm. And also more and more, we can use ammonia into engine systems, into marine and into the power sector. So for example, ammonia in Japan, what they are doing now is they are spiking ammonia into their coal fire plants to help decarbonize mm-hmm. and take out the nitrous oxide. So it's from a commodity play point of view, it becomes really interesting because you have today 170 million ton of ammonia traded every single day. So it's very easy to see what the price is of ammonia now and in the future. But that same molecule is now, instead of competing for one major market with fertilizer, is going to start competing for fertilizer, transport, and energy. And so we are going to see, you know, this shift which is going to come. And hydrogen is great for heavy goods transport, for trucking, for, you know, you can use it in your boilers. You know, a lot of people are scared, oh, is hydrogen going to explode if I use it in the boilers? Well, you know, some people will remember that actually up until the late 60s and, you know, until we had access to natural gas from the North Sea, we used town gas in our boilers. And guess what? Town gas was 25% hydrogen at the time. And so history repeats itself again and again. So it's, there's a lot of shifts going on, which are very interesting to us because we see this thing coming very fast, but you have a demand which is growing very fast, but the supply is not. So, which is one of the reasons we want to accelerate and that Atom was created. You know, Atom is, you know, it's a play a little bit in the fact that we're trying to accelerate. You know, it's a molecule that, you know, and you're trying to go faster because we want to take advantage of the disconnect that you have, which is a very fast growing demand for a molecule where the supply is not coming up. And if anything, it's coming down because today 30% of all hydrogen in the world is made in Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine. And that ammonia is not having an easy access to the market at the moment. So if you want to have an effect of, you know, in this side of 2030, you need to get going which is what we are trying to do.
And I think that's a very interesting way to approach it. As you say, that the market's not quite there yet for hydrogen, but it will be in the future. You've got the ammonia product to effectively make the business profitable and cash flow and continue to build on what you've got for fertilizer abuse and also, as you say, for it's the AdBlue, isn't it? It's used in trucking, isn't it, to help remove some of the NOx from exhaust fumes, but also, as you mentioned, in industry as well, to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. When do you see what's your forecast on the hydrogen market then, and where it's going to come? And also, I mean, we are sort of I'm interested to get your sort of thoughts as well on perhaps what's to come this winter. I have a bad feeling this winter is going to be quite a bit of a wake-up call for Western economies. We see in the United Kingdom that the energy price cap has insanely gone high. People are really going to struggle, I think, to heat their homes in the UK. In Europe, where I am, there's already cold water in Hanover. They are not heating the water in order to save energy or to save gas because they're preparing for this winter. I think it's going to be quite a wake-up call this winter. I think energy prices are going to be incredibly expensive, and I think you said at the start, energy drives policy, and I think the Germans made a big mistake by doing what they did with Russia and the gas, and now they're going to pay the price for that. Maybe just as we're coming up on an hour, I'm just kind of keen to get your thoughts on first of all, what you think is driving energy policy at the moment and what is to come perhaps this winter? And also, where do you see hydrogen fitting into the mix and in what sort of time frame?
So I think from a, well, you know, let's use numbers. You know, numbers don't lie, right? So at the moment, Germany, I think they just announced another peak of about 411 euros per megawatt hour, right? So it's 10 times what it was about a year ago. At the same time, in Paraguay, they just announced 2 days ago that the domestic electricity price for users, not industrial users, regular users, is coming down to $21 per kilowatt, right, per megawatt hour. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's just like, this is, it's just incredible, right? So what's driving policy? And this is kind of where I go back to egos, right? And unfortunately, there was this misconception that, you know, energy was incredibly available. We want to believe that it's going to be cheaper than what it was. But, you know, the same way that we have, let's say, allowed ourselves, as you know, I'll say in a European UK way, right, to say we will go very boldly in decarbonizing the system by investing massively in wind, in solar, and we will stop investing in natural gas or nuclear. And it was very easy to say, because what you didn't have to say is that the thing that will make up the difference is hydrocarbon-based energy that we have externalized to somebody else. Exactly the same way that, why is it that the carbon footprint or the carbon emissions of Europe and the UK keeps coming down for the past 10 years, and we are all very proud of that. It's not because we did something particularly proactive, it's because we have essentially sent our industrial production to other countries. So the carbon footprint from that industrial production has been sent to China, India, Pakistan, right, in some of these countries. So whilst we are very proud, all we've done is just, you know, we've just given our trash to somebody else, and we just ignored it was our trash. So that's one side. The other side is just also that, you know, unfortunately, we forgot that one of the big reasons that solar panel prices has come down massively, it's because 90% of all solar panels are now made in China, which is great for some aspects, much less for other aspects, which is, if we get into a real spat with China because of Taiwan, where the hell are we going to get cheap solar panels from? Right? So there's a whole combination of things where, unfortunately, it's not my quote, right? It's somebody else's quote, which said that, well, this is the consequence when you let, you know, a teenager dictate your energy policy based on emotions that something are happening and when we need to do something. But to an extent, experts were left out of the room for a long time. And this is essentially what happened, right? It's the people who knew about the stuff were told, you guys, you are part of the old system. We're having all of these renewable producers who say they can do this and they can accelerate that, and it's great. And guess what? Yes, it is possible, but these are 2040, 2050 plans. You know, what do we do in the middle? Which is why gas has been and continues to be a transition fuel from a, you know, from a carbon perspective. But gas, exactly like oil, number one, it's a finite resource, and number two, it comes from a very few amount of places. So your ability to become hostage to something becomes extremely high. So policy-wise, I thought was really interesting, and I'm not singling out the UK on this one whatsoever, because everybody is guilty of it. Where you see, you know, COP26 in the UK, our Minister of Energy who says, yes, we need to focus on green. We don't want to do anything else in the North Sea. We will stop investments, you name it. You know, comes January, February, you know, the first alerts, same minister says, well, no, we really think that we have to help the North Sea. It's important. We are going to reopen licensing. And then April, some of the super profits questions start coming in. Some of the taxation start coming in. We need to tax these super profits. And just a month later, the same minister complains that, well, why is it that oil and gas companies are not investing in energy in the North Sea? You're just like, well, you know, these are 20-year projects. You cannot spend flip-flopping every single 3 months because something else is happening and you might not look good in the press. So it's so where are we going? Well, the problem is we have been, to an extent, running around like headless chicken for quite a while. So because we haven't had a proper energy crisis for over 20 years, right? And it's the same way that some people are very worried about inflation now, because my generation, you know, never had, I'm 47. I never had to live through the early 80s inflation. So I don't know what it is, you know, so I couldn't predict because I never had to live it. But if you talk to anybody who was in an economist at that time, he say, well, yes, of course, we saw it from a mile away, but nobody listened to us. So I'm going in circles on this one, and I apologize because I don't have a very structured way of saying it. But the reality is, you know, to quote Game of Thrones, winter is coming. And we all know winter is coming, but there's still a whole bunch of people who don't believe in White Walkers.
Yeah. Right? I used that the other day, actually. I said, winter is coming, yeah. To quote Game of Thrones. Yeah, so you'd agree it's going to be a wake-up call?
It is, and the sad part of it is what are we going to be able to do,
yeah.
Right? It's going to be very easy, if you are in the Americas, to give lessons to the rest of the world, because the U.S. is, for lack of a better word, energy independent, right? Not 100%, but very largely energy independent. So the pressures that we are going to be living through in Europe and in the U.K., they will have zero understanding of, because they will say, well, you just have to buy Freedom Gas from the U.S. at $25 a BTU. Mm. And of course, they would say that because they will make money out of us, right? So it's going to be very difficult for politicians in both the EU and the UK to find the right balance where you want to keep the moral high ground on the fact that we have a very, let's say, unjust war going on between Ukraine and Russia. But we will have, as consumers, we will be the one paying the higher price. Yeah, yeah. I mean, not the human price. Please, like, you know, that's just so it's clear. Like, the human price is way worse than anything else. And so I certainly don't want to be in anybody's shoes, either it's on the Ukrainian or the Russian side. But from an economic price point of view, it will be the UK and EU consumer who will bear the cost of other people who will, you know, who will take decisions which may not be based on realities. So it won't be pretty, and I fear I don't know what it's going to lead to. You know, could it lead to more nationalism? That's certainly one aspect. Could it lead to more investments domestically? I certainly hope so, because as I said, we have allowed ourselves to outsource a lot of our primary goods to other countries without thinking of the long-term consequences. And whether you are China or Russia, when you have governments which don't have to follow the same democratic process that we have, you are not playing in the same game, right? It is, Russians are playing chess, you know, Chinese are playing mahjong. We are still playing checkers on a good day, because we have people who are spending at least one third of their time in electoral sessions. And unfortunately, common sense comes out of a window very quickly.
Yeah, indeed. It'd also be interesting where you position your money as well, your capital in this. I think it's anyone's guess, really, whether there could be opportunities to be had in energy stocks, energy companies, or whether things are going to get, you know, unpleasant and a lot of liquidation will happen. I think I'm probably hedging more on the latter option and heading more towards that.
I think consolidations will be the word on one hand. You are seeing that already happening even in the renewable sector. there's an acceleration of that. The other side is you also see some of the smart money going on, which is, you know, why is it that, you know, the largest investor by a long shot on hydrogen at the moment is Saudi Arabia? You know, why are they going into that direction now? It's because they, you know, as you remember when I said, you know, that because electricity price is the single biggest driver for the cost of hydrogen and therefore ammonia, then you have to invest massively today so that in 10 years' time, you will be the one able to produce hydrogen and ammonia cheaper than anybody else. Because that's the best way to go about it if you want to continue keeping an ownership of the energy market. Whilst for us, the great advantage of hydrogen and ammonia, it's a molecule, right? It's flexible. It has the flexibility that an electrons and cables will never have. Mm. So it will help accelerate the adoption a lot faster than electrification. And so the great dream today from a lot of countries is, if I have a wind farm, with that wind, I can produce hydrogen, and with a hydrogen, I can use it in trucks, in heat, in power. So I can use it from a decentralized basis, from a domestic basis. And that's absolutely how it should go, because you need to invest into that to be able to balance out the fact that another country can produce a lot of it for very cheap. But you need to keep everybody honest. So the more production you have domestically, the more you are able to arbitrage and keep some control over your energy policy. So I'm 100% for it. The reality is, you know, we are talking about terawatts of investments over 2050. But I think it's the segue I want to use into that is, the reality is, what is the potential for the hydrogen economy? It's essentially the ultimate potential. And I'm just quoting, there's a very good Goldman Sachs report on this one. And take everything Goldman Sachs writes, you take it with a, you know, grain of salt, but some of the very good principles are there. And it's just that by 2050, we will be able to produce, and when they say 2050, I'm thinking actually 2040, you'll be able to displace about 20% of oil and gas globally. So 20%, that's 20 million barrels a day. You know, it's a $2 billion a day market. That's how big the opportunity is. It's the time to do it now and to do it faster. Now, the question from an investor point of view, and which is, you know, where do you invest? Do you invest on the production side or do you invest on the technology side? And up until us, the only way to invest in the hydrogen economy was through the technology side via companies like ITM or Ceres Power. And nobody was doing the production side. And our focus is, well, it's all great. We all keep talking about, oh, we need to invest in the tech because somebody needs to, you know, we need to have the next generation of electrolyzers. I fear that we're going to be in a situation very much like what happened to solar, where very quickly the people who actually made the, you know, the difference and the real money were the people who were applying the tech, not the one creating the tech. And you need to create the molecule, right? I don't need another type of electrolyzer. Mm. What I need is hydrogen and ammonia into my energy system. And which is what Atom Play is, right? It's for us. It is to be a producer. And yes, we got the green economy mark from the London Stock Exchange. And I think it is actually something that you have to go through a process at the LSE. You have to show that more than 50% of your production or your income is related to something green. And it was an interesting test case because actually they never had in the taxonomy of the way they had written it. It was always, they had never thought originally when they wrote the rules, I think it was back in 2016, there was no allocation for green fuels. Because the assumption was, well, a fuel has to be hydrocarbon, so a fuel cannot be a recipient of the green taxonomy. So we had to present the arguments, present the case, present the opportunity, exactly what we did. And then the LSE was agile enough to recognize it very quickly and gave us the green economy mark, because our focus has absolutely been into creating molecules which are essentially green and definitely greener than the hydrocarbon molecules.
Yeah, well done indeed for getting that. It's a nice mark to have. And I think I've really enjoyed this conversation. We haven't spoken so much about Atome Energy, but I mean, we did do that interview with you just the other week, and that gives a nice summary of the company and the business model. But I think this discussion on energy and hydrogen has been very insightful. I've very much enjoyed it, but I wonder if it's worth maybe, Kenny, have you got any further points, or we can maybe summarise and maybe throw Olivier the 60-second challenge?
Yeah, I think that'd be a good way to end, Mark. I was just quite happy sitting listening to you two guys talking away. I almost felt like I was listening to a podcast for the last 10 minutes, which is good.
Good.
That's the way it should be. But indeed. Yeah, 60-second challenge, I think, would be a good way to finish.
Maybe we just throw that in, Olivia. We haven't given you a warning about this, but really, we sometimes do it just to finish off the podcast. Just give the guests 60 seconds to really make the elevator pitch for the company, the investment opportunity. So, I mean, are you up for the challenge?
I'll try. Yes,
sure. Yeah, no problem. Well, I can count you in. So let me just get a clock up here. Yep. Okay. So. I'll go. Don't worry about too much, but you know, if you can get the 60 seconds, then that's bonus points. So in 3, 2, 1, take it away.
So Atome is the first company listed on the London Stock Exchange focused on the production of green hydrogen and green ammonia, with our first projects in Paraguay, where we have a pipeline of projects of about 400 megawatt of hydrogen to ammonia. And Iceland in up to 100 megawatt. But the first project, which is now going through front-end engineering and design, is our 60 megawatt project in Villeta, which will be in production and producing ammonia by 2025. So we will be one of the first and fastest project in the world to be a large-scale producer. So it's quite exciting time for us to be here, and we are certainly looking towards greening the energy and fertilizer sector in a time of energy and food security.
There we go, 58 seconds I got that, so well done. You've got it all there nicely within a minute. That's perfect. Yeah. Now listen, it's been great having a chat to you. I hope you've enjoyed it as well. I'm sure the people listening will find it very interesting. I'm glad we're having these discussions now. Well ahead of what's to come. There's some great opportunities, I think, in this space, particularly the green investment space. And I'm very pleased that we're sort of talking about it now. You know, ahead of the curve.
No. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Kenny. For having us, and I really want to say us at Atome. We certainly hope to be, you know, that investing in hydrogen and green ammonia, because it's the market, is going to be recognized very quickly. That, you know, Web 3.0 is great, but you know, Energy 2.0 is what's needed.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure, Olivier.
Yeah, thank you, Mark.
For time. Cheers.
Cheers, Kenny.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.